Blog Talk Radio.
Also, there's another concept of freedom.
by Toni Morrison. She stated, "The function of freedom is to free someone else." Now, that's a very interesting concept of freedom. Again, Toni Morrison stated, "The function of freedom is to free someone else." Now, how do all of these concepts by these various individuals, how do their concept relate to your concept of understanding of freedom? How will you apply it in your daily lives as we continue to struggle for this concept of freedom? So we just want to give you something to think about, and later on the program, if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, we'll give you an opportunity to share your thoughts on freedom. So right now, what we're going to do right now, we're going to MPH Black Benefax. As we talk about our Black Benefax for the week, we would like to bring in Susie, who is a member and contributor of Missing Pages of History. Susie, welcome to MPH Radio.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. For this week, we'll be doing it 21st through the 27th of March, 2021. And on the 21st, First Mini Black Facts, Sharpeville Massacre, South African police gunned down peaceful demonstrators against past laws in 1960. Also, Namibia gains independence from South Africa in 1990. That was March the 21st. The 22nd, representatives from Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Transjordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Yemen met in Cairo to establish the Arab League in 1945. 23rd, Walter Rodney, Pan-Africanist, author, historian, and revolutionary, was born in 1942 on March the 23rd. March the 24th, African students rose up against neo-colonists closing the university in Madagascar in 1971. On March the 25th, Selma March reaches state capital in Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. And also, Ida B. Wells died in 1931. On the 26th of March, Ahmed Sekou Touré died, and this was in 1984 on the 26th of March. And the last and final one for the week, Shirley Graham Du Bois, author and Pan-Africanist, died in 1977 on March the 27th.
Like you.
And these are just some mini facts for the week of March the 21st through the 27th.
We'd like to thank Susie for presenting her MPH Black Mini Facts, and we'd like to remind you that our history is a powerful tool not only to remember but also to learn and apply it in our daily lives. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take an MPH station break, and when we come back, we have a message from the community by Mr. Alex Joyner. You're listening to MPH Radio, and let's stay together. That's right. Let's Stay Together, coming from the MPH community, reacting our friends, supporters, and people in general. The secret to life is having unity. Let's stay together and build our underserved communities and make humanity a better place for all mankind. Yes, Brother Al, let's stay together. We welcome you back. You're listening to the voice of MPH Radio. Right now, what we're going to do, we're going to have a special message from the community from Brother Algis Jones. His words and his wisdom are solely the opinion and expression of Mr. Joyner, Algis Joyner, and we hope that you will take heed to his call. Mr. Joyner, what is your message to the community for today? We now will bring you Mr. Alex Joyner. The mic is yours, Mr. Joyner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lee. And I would like to thank all the callers who are listening in today, and I'd like to thank Susie. And I would like to also thank our honored guests today, because there are many stories out there that need to be told, because this is history. It's not recorded now, not registered upon our minds and our souls. It will be lost as we begin to lose so many of our elders. And with the situation in Georgia and 42 other states, it sort of brought me back to, as a child, my memories of seeking that right to vote and understanding it. So today, I would like to honor the audience with one man, one vote, one man, one vote, one man, one vote. The rain started slowly on that early February morning, and the wind was blowing strong. I could hear the rain turn into a strong drumbeat as it beat down on the tin top roof of my house. Today, I decided not to be deterred by weather or poor health. I felt a slight chill, and I knew I probably had a fever, but nothing was stopping me from taking this bus ride into history. All month, they had interviewed the children at school going on a special trip to Greensboro, North Carolina, to visit the national famed city and lunch counter at Woolworth. And then we would march with the voting protesters. Our principal and others had made the necessary arrangements for our safety and taught us how to march in line, one behind the other, so as not to break line or run when hollered at. We were told about vicious dogs and the use of negative insults against us. We children were not afraid. Most of us had marched before. We knew how to hold hands and lock arms if necessary to keep from being separated. Most of all, we were kids who knew the real fighting was for the grown-ups. We just wanted new books, a new playground, repairs to our school, and to be treated like the white kids who were now being integrated into our school. We boarded the buses and arrived at Woolworth in Greensboro. The store didn't seem so big to me. There was stuff all over the place, and the counter was even dirty with dishes and cups. Why was this place so special, I thought. We walked back to the bus and gathered our signs we had made in class and walked about 6 blocks into disaster. White people were shouting all kinds of racial slurs and insults at us. We were just kids with signs, and it seemed as if they wanted to kill us. The cops that restrained them were also telling us to go back to Africa where we came from. I thought we were all Americans. Where in Africa did they want me to go back to? I didn't know anyone in Africa. Soon, we had made our way to the front of the crowd, and I heard a unifying cry. One man, one vote. One man, one vote. One man, one vote. Even to this day, as I cast my ballot, I hear that cry in my ears and feel the same passion in my heart. The Voting Rights Act, which my ancestors died to defend, are now in jeopardy by the Republican political party. Soon, many poor, disenfranchised voters will lose their right to vote. The Jim Crow laws of the past are creeping back upon us. The days of guessing how many jelly beans are in a jar, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap, or how many stars are in the sky can be used again to test the people of color's right to vote. The voter suppression agenda is new to today's youth, but it was bad news for millions of blacks as they tried to register vote in the 1960s. Violence and intimidation were one record. Literacy tests and poll taxes were others. Property ownership and grandfather clauses were other obstacles to overcome. The all-white primary election excluded people of color. The purge of records of black voters was commonplace. Former black prisoners with minor offenses could not even vote, so the federal government said they could. During the 1950s and well into the 1960s, African-American literacy rates were dismal. Many of our grandparents and parents had little formal education and could not understand the laws being enacted against them. Today, we are more educated than our ancestors, yet we may fall victim to the very same law. Many years ago, I bravely carried a sign on a cold, rainy, and windy day in Greensboro that simply said, I am somebody, while others walk ahead or behind me shouting, one man, one vote, one man, one vote, one man, one vote. Now, I truly know the importance of voting. Thank you.
You have just heard Mr. Alex Joyner and his message to the underserved communities. At this particular time, we're going to take a quick station break, and when we come back, we will come back and introduce you to our special guest, Mr. Robert L. Green, as we discuss the title of this program, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. This is MPH Radio.
I believe The children are our future. Keep them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we
our transition to our special guest today and to our theme today, which is At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. In the process of introducing our guest, we think we could best maybe give you a description of who he is by talking about just a little bit about some of his milestones in his life, Mr. Rob L. Green. We know that in 1933, he was born in Detroit, Michigan. In 1952, he attended Detroit Northern High School. In 1963, he earned a PhD from Michigan State University. In 1965, he became the education director for Martin Luther King and Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In 1966, he led the Jane Murder March against Field in Mississippi. In 1977, he authored the Urban Challenges, Poverty and Race. In 2014, he authored of Expectations. In 2014, served as the Clark County, Nevada chairman of My Brother's Keepers. In 2015, he became the author of the book At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. Those are just some of the milestones in the life of Mr. Robert L. Green. At this point in time, we'd like to bring Mr. Green in, and we'd like to welcome him to Missing Pages of History. Mr. Green, welcome to Missing Pages of History Radio.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here today, and I'm happy to hear that you're speaking in favor of voting rights in the state of Georgia. That's very important to me because my dad was born in Georgia in, 2000. No, yeah, okay. And he was drafted in the Army, I got my dates mixed up. 2019, that's when it was, 2019. Drafted in the Army, spent time in Europe, came back, and could not vote in Georgia. So I'm glad you're talking about voting rights, and we want to encourage and support our many colleagues in the state of Georgia who are fighting for the right to exercise the great American right, namely the right to vote. So thank you for that. One other quick thing. I can remember the year. I can remember this year. It was in the year, summer of 66. I went with Fannie Lou Hamer in Sunflower County, Mississippi, to the voting rights office, seeking an opportunity to help her and 13 others become registered voters in Mississippi, and we were turned away and all called the N-word. So voting rights is important, not just in Georgia, but in Mississippi, Detroit, Chicago, and throughout the nation. I encourage all blacks and people of goodwill to become registered voters and vote for democracy. And I think I need to stop and let you ask questions.
Mr. Green, you know, we want you to share as much as you can about anything that you think is of value, for particularly our youth and our people to learn more about our history. And that's what we're all about. Now, when we talk about you, Mr. Green, a lot of times people say, sometimes that's old saying, you are who you keep, the company that you keep. And I noticed in reading your book and doing a little bit of research on you, you are an interesting individual in terms of the individuals that you have had the chance to work with and come into your life in terms of historical figures that a lot of people may not know about. I would like for you to talk just a little bit about some of the individuals that you have had a chance to meet and work with and give us your take on their significance in terms of how their work have impacted the lives of our people and the world in general. So I'm going to ask you right now, talk about some of the people that you have worked with that not only have influenced you, but you also have influenced them. Because when we talk about history, everybody has a history. And you are an icon right in your own field, Mr. Green. So talk a little bit to our audience about some of the people that have influenced you and you have influenced them. The mic is yours.
Well, one person that had an impact on me was Martin Luther King Jr. And I went to work for him. I took a leave from the university in 1965 and worked full-time. I left Michigan State and worked full-time for Martin Luther King Jr. And he asked me to help them, believe it or not, with voting rights in the state of Mississippi. And that's when I became aware of the importance of voting. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. did something that no other, to my knowledge, civil rights leader ever did. He helped blacks overcome fear and fight for freedom. And example, my dad was a very quiet man who had very little to say, born and raised in a place called Jones County, Georgia, Haddock Station near Macon, not far from Macon, Georgia. And my father was always kind of a careful, almost fearful man, even after moving to Detroit. And I never really fully understood why until one year we were sitting talking, and he shared this with me. When my father was 14 years of age, he and another buddy, a friend of his, in the woods, looking out of the woods, saw 30 white men lynch a young black guy, a man, hanging from a tree. And I asked my father, what did he do to experience such a horrific crime? My father said he did nothing. Said whites in Jones County, Georgia at that time would occasionally lynch one black to make sure they kept other blacks in control. So my father was always careful and concerned about survival, but also doing the right thing. But he had fear instilled in him at 14 years of age by a mob of 30, 35 white men in Jones County, Georgia. So I began to understand my dad's fear. And I never will forget Martin Luther King Jr. made this statement several times. once or twice in my presence. He said, if you don't have anything that you will die for, maybe you don't want to live. And I will never forget that. I thought that was a pretty tough statement at the time. But knowing the love and care and generosity of Martin Luther King Jr., I understood what he was saying. He was saying, don't be afraid of anybody, any man. He said at the Church of God in Christ there in Memphis the night before he was assassinated. Well, it was not, yeah, but the night before he was assassinated. He said, I don't fear any man. So fear is something that Martin Luther King Jr. helped the black community overcome. And I write about that in my book, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. Are you going to be fearful or are you going to be free? And as you know, I heard on your program, freedom is something that doesn't come easy. Freedom is something you fight for. Freedom is something that you're willing to die for. So my dad went to France fighting during World War One for America as a soldier, lived in a foxhole in the ground for 14 months, came back to the United States, went back to Georgia, and was denied the right to vote. That's why voting is so important today and so important to me. So in my book, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom, The Fight for Social and Educational Justice, I cite Martin Luther King Jr. as the man who stepped out and said, don't be afraid to fight for freedom. Don't be afraid to fight for what's right. And he gave his life fighting for freedom. And I point that out in my book, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. Thank God I had an opportunity to work for him and to meet his wife, and his wife and my wife were good friends, and to know all of the children. And his children knew my children. And Martin Luther King Jr. was a man that taught Americans that black people aren't going to be afraid anymore. We're not going to be afraid to fight for freedom. Take our lives, we may attempt to take our lives, but we're still going to fight for freedom. And I would be happy to comment on that any way further. In my book, I have some pictures of myself with Martin Luther King Jr. in Mississippi on the highway. We marched from Grenada, Mississippi to Jackson, Mississippi after James Meredith was shot. We did that to demonstrate that we weren't afraid. Martin Luther King Jr. walked with us all the way from Grenada to Jackson. That was in the summer of 66. Whites threw rocks at us. They put snakes in the back of our truck when we were asleep at night. They did all sorts of terrible things that allowed the American press, the Washington Post, and other newspapers to understand how evil people can behave when they're driven by treating people the wrong way. Okay. So I would be happy to comment on that any further if you wish.
Yeah, no problem. Mr. Green, can you also talk about some of the other people that you was in company and work with, such as your relationship with Andrew Young, Ivanhoe Donaldson? I'm quite sure you had the chance to meet Amos Stokely Carmichael. Talk about some of the historical individuals, people I know you had a relationship with them, because they say you are.
Andrew Young was one of my best friends, still is. We talk almost every day. He's still alive. I am 86 years of age. Andy Young is 88. And we talk almost every day about the past, about freedom. Ivanhoe Donaldson was a student of mine at Michigan State, and he worked with me in Farmville, Virginia, another terrible place when faced with the possibility of school desegregation. The County Board of Supervisors in Farmville shut the school system down for blacks, but gave whites an opportunity to go on to school. Ernie Green of the Little Rock Nine was a student of mine at Michigan State. We still are good friends. I talked to Ernie Green on yesterday. Stokely Carmichael, you could tell he left here and went to Guinea and died in Guinea. And Stokely would tell people that I saved his life. And if you can look in my book at the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom, you'll see a picture of me blocking a highway patrolman in Mississippi who was going to shoot Stokely Carmichael. Stokely was only trying to protect Martin Luther King Jr., and a highway, Mississippi highway patrolman was going to put a bullet in his head, and I blocked Stokely so that could not occur. Martin Luther King Jr. said we all had an obligation. If we thought one was in danger and was about to take a bullet, we should take the bullet for them. And I was prepared to take a bullet for Stokely Carmichael, who was trying to protect Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, these are some of the people I worked with. And the stories I'm citing now are in my book at the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. And if you go online, you can find the book. Or better yet, drop a note to me, and I'll be happy to give you a copy of the book at cost. Okay.
And what we'll do, Mr. Green, before you leave, we'll make sure you can leave that information with our listening audience so they know how to get in contact with you to get the book. We will make sure we do that. Now, I find that philosophy really interesting about being committed to one another and you die for each other. Do you think that's a kind of philosophy that is missing among our young students, young pupils, young children today?
Yeah, I think it's something we need to help instill in young people. Martin Luther King Jr. used to always say, protect someone today. He never said protect yourself. He said protect someone else. And we need to let high school, junior, I've spoken to junior high and high school students. I said, don't fight each other. Support each other. That's what Martin Luther King Jr. taught us to do. He even expanded it to the extent that black and Hispanic students, Mexican-American students, were fighting at a high school in Las Vegas where I was working as kind of a support person. And they called a school auditorium. They called a meeting of all black and Mexican-American students in a school auditorium. 500 or 600 came. I said, look, do you know that Martin Luther King Jr. and Cesar Chavez were very close friends? Of course, they knew who Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King was. And I said, as a matter of fact, a week before Martin was assassinated, he was on his way to see Cesar Chavez. When I told those kids that shared that history with them, there was no more fighting at that school between black and Mexican-American students. So sometimes it's a lack of knowledge that causes individuals to make the wrong decision or a bad decision. And Martin Luther King Jr., Stokely Carmichael, and others whom I worked with, and Ivan O. Donaldson, who was deceased, they always made good decisions, and their decisions were centered around protecting people and supporting freedom and educational justice and not fighting each other. I often would say to my young kids in places like Detroit or in Las Vegas, no, you don't fight each other. You support each other. You love each other. And you need the support of each other. And when you talk to kids in kind of a nice, calm, pleasant way, they understand, they listen, and will often do the right thing.
You know, Mr. Green, one of the things in your own right, you also made your contribution to our people movement and to humanity. I want you to talk a little bit. I know you're real humble, but talk just a little bit about some of the areas in which you participated and you made a contribution to our people development in the field of education. We know that you was Dr. King, SAIC, education director. And when you look at some of these major cases and movement, many people don't know that you played a real intricate part in your education. And matter of fact, one thing I'm really interested in your book in terms of your analysis is that you stated that all the things the king should be known for, one of the greatest things that we don't talk about in terms of his legacy is the importance of education. So can you talk a little bit about your role as educator and some of the battles that you had to deal with and this narrative of why is it that maybe when one talk about king, they leave out the importance of our people to be educated?
Yeah. King was a strong supporter of education. And I tell young people, Martin Luther King Jr. finished high school when he was 14 or 15. At 26, he had finished his doctorate. He strongly believed in education and pushed education. And that's why he said, when he said to me, he said, Robert L. Green, he used to call me Professor. Professor Green, I want you to come work with me and help me share from a national perspective the importance of education for our young people. And I did that. I did it because of Martin Luther King Jr.'s leadership and the fact that he was so absolutely correct. So one of the messages we should give young people around the country, especially young African-American kids, they should know that King did not just march for so-called human and civil rights. He marched for educational justice as well, and I point that out in the book. And he was a model for us. He was a role model for us, and that he showed us how education can change your life and benefit you and your family in a very positive way. You know, his father was well-educated. His sister, Christine Ferris, was well-educated. And A.D., whom I knew, Margaret's brother, was also an educated person. But King always believed in serving as a role model, and he did that in a very effective way. So, yes, education is important. King pushed it. And, you know, the other people I knew, like Stokely Carmichael, Ivan Hope Donaldson, they all were good students. Ivan Hope was a student at Michigan State University when I was on the faculty there. So he was one who really spent his life supporting education and believed in it strongly. So, yes, King and his people that he worked with, Andy Young, was a tremendous believer in education and a scholar and a supporter of Martin Luther King Jr. But King led us all. He was a role model for all of us. And he used to compliment me and thank me for getting my PhD. I said, well, I got my PhD not because I felt that I wanted to be such a strong scholar, but that was part of it. I said, I got a PhD to show young people that education can be a force in the area of social justice. And truly, it is, was, and is today.
You know, speaking of your PhD and a scholar, you use this concept, scholar activist. Can you define that for us? What is a scholar activist? And do we need more scholar activists today?
Yes. A scholar activist is a person who uses their training in education, their experience in education, being a good reader, a good writer, to benefit others, promote social change. My colleagues at Michigan State, most who happen to be white, would argue with me how I would push education and relate it to social justice. And I said, they are intertwined. I said, my scholarship as a person is worthless if I can't use it to benefit the poor, if I can't use it to benefit the downtrodden. unless I can use my education and go into Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and help people become registered voters. You get that education, but you use it in such a way to promote social justice. And that's so very important. Education in itself may not mean a lot. It's okay to say you have a PhD and you have a brother who's an MD and so forth. But what do they do to use their education to promote others? I've been blessed. I've got three sons. One son was a PhD in electrical engineering. One's a lawyer. And one has an MBA in finance. But I tell them that investment in education that you've made is not simply to promote yourself and your family, but to help others, to help the least of these. That's what I've pushed all of my life, that my PhD was only so good to the extent that it helped others live a better life. And that I believe in that years ago, and I believe in it today. Barack Obama. I'm looking at some books on my shelf. One book, My Life, My Love, My Legacy by Coretta Scott King. When Martin Luther King died, she didn't just disappear and go around the country giving speeches to raise money for the King Center. She did some of that, but she also promoted the social justice philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. Barack Obama became a leader in this country and used education to promote justice. Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote the recent book on caste, is another person that I respect from a scholarship standpoint. So, yes, you use education to make America a better place for all.
Brother Green, one of the things King talked about, and I just had to get your assessment on this phenomenon, as one critique the capitalist system that we live in, and you talk about the three-head evil, the three-head monster that makes up capitalism, as he talk about the evils, what can a conscious educator do today to fight against that particular type of evil that still exists as we look at the world, in turn, the majority of the people are still oppressed. The majority of the world is still fighting this issue we call racism. The majority of this world is still fighting poverty. So what role does an educator and the role of education should play as it relates to fighting the three-headed monster as we talk about this evil system that people call capitalism?
He talks about evil. He talks about war, poverty, as being central factors, evils in this world. And I agree with him that in dealing with the triple evils of the world requires a commitment. And I always say that I call that commitment the fight for social and educational justice in America and in the world. King was totally committed to dealing with those evils. One, he was against war. And the other big one was really poverty. Poverty. Making sure, he said, in a country like America, no one should go to bed hungry at night. You know, and just think about that. How people are starving all over the world. Sometimes I see those captions on TV of starving children in Africa, and it just makes me sick. But we have some in America, Gary, Indiana, Detroit. They may not be starving at the level you see starvation in Africa, but it does occur. So King's effort to deal with injustice, war, poverty is something that we need to try to reinforce even more so today than we have in the past.
You know, Mr. Green, one of the connections you made in your book at the crossroad of fear and freedom, the fight of social and educational justice, one of the narratives that you talk about is you did a connection between the apartheid system in Zambia, South Africa, and the Jim Crow system in U.S., and y'all look at these two systems as one and the same. Now, can you talk a little bit about the work that you contribute towards the new phenomenon of breaking down the apartheid system as well as the Jim Crow? This is one of your legacies when I read your book that came to mind in terms of you were one of the many unknown heroes and sheroes that our people don't know about. So just talk a little bit about that time period.
I was in South Africa during the apartheid days. Believe it or not, I enjoyed tennis as a sport. And Arthur Ashe came to me and said, I've been asked to play tennis in South Africa, but I don't want to go there because of apartheid. And so they kept pressuring him. The government, believe it or not, the government of South Africa, led by a man by the name of Owen Williams, they were very much in favor of sports. So Arthur said, can you help me? I said, look, let me talk to Owen. So I said, I did reach Owen Williams, and I said, Arthur is not going to play before a segregated, racially segregated audience in South Africa. He said, if he agrees to do it, the condition of desegregation has to be met. So there had never been a desegregated, racially desegregated event in South Africa. So I went back to Owen and told him what the condition was. And he said, okay. And he got the South African government to allow Arthur to play tennis in the Ellis, that's E-L-L-I-S Stadium in South Africa before a mixed race of blacks and whites and Indians. I went with him. And that had never happened before. So the breakdown of apartheid in South Africa was centered around a sporting event. And a lot of people don't realize the importance that sports can play sometimes in breaking barriers, like Jackie Robinson did in baseball. And Arthur Ashe did it with tennis in South Africa. I was in South Africa with my wife just 2 or 3 years ago, and I passed Ellis Stadium, and it brought back memories of the past. How Arthur Ashe played Jimmy Connors in a tennis match there to desegregate that facility, and that led to later on the political desegregation that eventually occurred in South Africa.
Point in time, you're listening to MPH Radio. We are discussing the life of Mr. Robert L. Green. He wrote a book in which, if you ever get a chance, you'll get this book titled At the Crossroads of Field and Freedom, The Fight for Social and Educational Justice. Mr. Green, before we take this station break, I would like for you to speak to our listening audience about this concept and maybe discuss what's the difference between the concept of education equity versus education equality. What is the distinction between the two?
What is what? I didn't hear the last point.
Can you discuss the difference between the concept? Can you discuss the difference between the concept of education equity? You use the word equity more so than equality. What's the difference between this issue of education equality versus education equity?
Equity and equality are factors that often interface. If you have equal education in terms of money, instruction, and so forth, it leads to educational equity. You can't have one without the other. The two are related. In the United States of America, for example, the funding of public education is tied to educational equity. And you need to have money and resources to build a strong educational system. So the two are related. Equity is something that leads to quality, because whites in America, they will always have equity for their kids. And those who are well off, they will fight for equity from an educational standpoint for their kids. So you can't have, usually you don't have one without the other.
Okay, at this point in time, we're going to take a station break. When we come back, we will continue the discussion with Mr. Rob L. Green, and we will invite our listening audience to call in at 818-337-0016. If you have a comment or question that you would like to ask them, please hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last one number. Again, if you have a question or comment that you would like to ask, then you listen to this program, please hit 1, and we'll acknowledge your last one numbers. So we're going to pause for the station break, and we are on the front line with Mr. Robert L. Green. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio. Front line. Welcome back to MPH Radio. We're discussing the life and the contributions of our brother, Robert L. Green. We will continue the discussion, and you can join us by calling in at 818-337-0016. Hit 1, and we will acknowledge the last four numbers. So we welcome everyone back. Earlier, when we were talking about different individuals that may have influence and work with Brother Green, we mentioned the name Stokely Carmichael. And for our young people today, if you do your historical research on the name Stokely Carmichael, you also need to associate Stokely Carmichael with Kwame Ture. He later on, when he left the U.S. in 68, he changed the name to Kwame Ture. So that's just a little side note for historical reference. And we will continue our discussion with our brother, Mr. Robert L. Green. He's an iconic figure in his own right. We ask everyone to write a book and leave it for our people so we can learn about our history from our perspective. This is one of the roles of MPH Radio, and it's one of the objectives of the organization, Missing Pages of History. We want educated writers, historians, and we want the everyday brothers and sisters to write and tell their own story. And we are very honored to have a special guest with us today, Mr. Robert Green, who have done an excellent job on telling his story and his contribution, not only to his people's development, but to all good for mankind, for humanity. The book At the Crossroads of Freedom, of Fear and Freedom, The Fight for Social and Educational Justice. Get that book, check it out, make it a part of your library. Mr. Green, right now what we're going to do, we have some listeners who call in who would like to make a comment or question for you. And what we're going to do, we can go to Brother Alex and let Brother Alex come in. Brother Alex, your question or comment to Mr. Green. The mic is yours. Yes, we're waiting for Brother Alex. Your question or comment, please. While we're waiting for Brother...
Yes. Hello?
Yes. Yes, we have.
Okay.
We hear you. The mic is yours.
Okay. All right. Yes, Mr. Green, Professor Green. Excuse me, sir. I wanted to ask you just a few questions, and I'll start off with the first one, because Stokely, as he was known during your area, being one of the students that you were so closely associated. And I thank you for reaching out and bringing many other students to Michigan State University and perhaps to go on to other universities. I noticed that in your book, how you were able to encourage others to be successful in education also. But concerning Mr. Carmichael and all the incidents that you went through, just like, say, John Lewis with the Good Trouble. I was wondering, because I myself for a long time, you know, always loved Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, and it seemed to me that, you know, they were the fighting forces out there that were attempting to see, to get things done in the spotlight. And I understand that you were doing things in the background that preceded a lot of the talk that we witness on the camera. But there's so much education that was needed on both sides of the aisle. Because again, like I said opening, there were so many of our people that were uneducated. So I would like to know, you know, what was your contribution to bringing forth those students? You know, what was your approach to make them take that lifelong commitment to educating themselves and carrying it on to their children, just like you did. So you can
well,
answer that. I appreciate it.
Well, I was blessed in that I got my PhD at a very early age. Got it when I was around 24, 25 years of age at Michigan State. And it was always my philosophy, PhD, a master's or a bachelor's degree, was meaningless. It didn't have any meaning unless you in some way could use that to help other people. And my white colleagues used to fight with me all the time. They used to say, you're not a scholar. You're not a true scholar because you use your writings talking about hunger and poverty and so forth. And I use those writings to serve as an advocate to get rid of poverty, to get rid of war, to get rid of injustice. That's why I think Martin Luther King Jr. was attracted to me, because he knew of my work in Farmville, Virginia, where they closed the schools, the county supervisors closed the schools rather than desegregate the schools. King knew about that. He knew about my work with Fannie Lou Hamer over in the Sunflower County, Mississippi. We went in, Fannie Lou Hamer led me, I should say, and 13 other blacks to the county courthouse, and I walked up front, and I said, we wanted to get these people registered to vote, and they wouldn't allow us to become registered voters. King knew the importance that I had, the feeling I had that was related to the importance of relating education to social justice. So when I finished my PhD, all of my writing, my 15 books, deals with social justice and how education can be used to serve as a social justice force in the lives of others. Now, in that, I was pretty much an out front person on education. I met a lot of people like Stokely Carmichael very early on. Met Stokely. I think I met him and Ivanhoe Dowd. I know Ivanhoe was a student of mine at Michigan State University. He introduced me to Stokely Carmichael in Mississippi, I think during the summer of 66. Now, why was I in Mississippi the summer of 66? Martin Luther King Jr. asked me to provide leadership for a march that James Meredith started and was shot to show blacks that they didn't have to be afraid, that they could march through a state like Mississippi and it would be okay. So I learned early on through my work with Martin Luther King Jr. the real serious importance of education and social justice. So whenever I talked about social justice, I related it to education. And King was a force in that, of course. He was the expert on, pardon me, relating the two. Now, we had Brother Stokely, who was a close friend of mine and would always say, Robert L. Green, you saved my life. If you look at my book on education and social justice, you'll see a picture of myself, Martin Luther King Jr., Floyd McKissick, and Stokely Carmichael, and some highway patrolmen. We were marching on a highway in Mississippi, and the highway patrolman told us to get off the highway to march on the shoulder. And King said, we don't want to march on the shoulder because it's wet. We're only trying to march to Jackson, Mississippi. And the highway patrolman said, I don't care if you're going to China. Get off the highway. And quick, King said, but we don't want to march to China. We just want to march to Jackson, Mississippi. That infuriated the highway patrol when King made that comment. And one started to hit King with his club. Stokely Carmichael raised his fist to hit the highway patrolman. And I saw this. I saw the highway patrolman reaching for unholstering, getting his gun. I knew it was going to happen. So I jumped across Martin King and grabbed Stokely and wrestled Stokely to the ground and put my body on top of his and looked up. I said, okay, shoot Stokely, you got to shoot me. And that's what King, I got that from Martin Luther King Jr. I was not an originator. I only acted out what he taught me to act out. So that's one of the stories in that book, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. Martin Luther King Jr. used to always say, if you don't have something to die for, maybe you don't need to live. When he first made that statement, I had to think about it, because fear was a part of the black community. I'm repeating this because it's in the book and I've said it before. My dad was a very fearful man, and I always wondered why. He told me that when he was 14 years of age, he and another black kid saw their best friend, 14 years of age, hung from a tree in Georgia. And I said, well, Dad, what did he do? He said he didn't do anything wrong. So the whites occasionally in Georgia, station Jones County, would lynch a black to keep other blacks under control. And so there's one thing I need to do that I have not done as much as I write. Stacey Abrams, I need to send her a note and tell her to keep up the good work in Georgia, because my dad went and fought in France during World War I. I'm going to get that right. Yeah, World War. I got a son here who fact checks me as I talk, because I'm old, so you got to understand that. Yeah, it was World War I, and my dad had to fight in the war, came back to the States, and couldn't vote. And that's what Stacey Abrams is fighting for in Georgia today, the right to vote. And so that right to vote has a history that we need to understand. Okay, I'll take a question now. I'm just doing all the talking.
Okay, Professor Green, we'd like to have your permission, if possible. Like we said, we're honored to have you on our program. We did agree to a certain amount of time, and we have gotten to that amount of time. If we could get your permission, or if you got the time, you have a few more minutes just to take a few more phone calls. And we're going to have to bring you back, but there are so many things that we haven't gotten to that we think is very important in what you have done. So it's all right on your behalf if we could take a few more calls if you got the time.
Yeah, I'll take a few more calls. I got the time.
Okay, let's do that. Let's go to Susie. Welcome to MPH Radio. Your question or comment, Susie?
Yes, Professor Green, I'd like to ask you, given the climate of COVID virus, how would Dr. King speak to us about taking the vaccination at this day and time, you think?
I would guess that even though King knew, and we all remember Tuskegee, Alabama, in which white scientists deliberately injected something worse than the virus, syphilis, into black men as a part of a study. A lot of folks remember that, and they are afraid. But I look at it this way, and I think King would share my point of view. There are more checks and balances today than there was years ago. And I think that the penalty that people would pay for injecting into your system a virus that's unhealthy is high. There was no penalty when the syphilis study in Tuskegee, Alabama, was in force. Whites did what they wanted to do to get the kind of research in place that they wanted in place. That typically doesn't happen today. There is a penalty that you face. King, I think, would ask people to consider the vaccine. The vaccine took care of polio. We haven't had a polio case in years. And I think the vaccine would take care of the challenges that we're faced with today. I think, King's point of view. That's my point of view.
Okay, next we will go to caller 2714. Caller 2714, the mic is yours.
Yes, 2714. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Greetings, brother Africa, brother Lee. And I just want to make a comment towards Dr. Green's presentation and also ask a question. I just want to tell Dr. Green I appreciate his experience and his contribution for African people here in America and abroad. And the question I want to ask more specifically was, can you recall any additional conversation with Arthur Ashe in regards to his fight involvement with apartheid in Africa. Was he interested in any other being participating in any other fights and struggles of Africa at that time? I know he participated in D.C. in a mass march against the apartheid, but I was just curious to know if he was involved in any or had interest to get involved with any other struggles in Africa.
The apartheid one was the big issue. I've got a copy of a book, the book he wrote in South Africa, and he has a note in the book. He says, "Bob Green, we need to do something about the 80 million. And he put 80 million. I didn't know it was 80 million blacks at that time in South Africa. And Arthur Ashe fought for voting rights in the States. I had him up to Michigan State University, and he was going around speaking to college campuses about segregation in America, the bad aspects of segregation in the United States. So, yes, he had an interest in South Africa, but Arthur Ashe had an interest in social justice. And he was a rare athlete, black or white. He was rare. Arthur was different. Now, Arthur believes that you should use your notoriety or strength as an athlete to fight for social justice. And a lot of people didn't know that. When I had him to speak at Michigan State before about 3,000 or 4,000 students, they were amazed at how knowledgeable he was about discrimination in America and how he spoke out against it, how he had struggles tennis court, on and off the tennis court, a struggle that a lot of us don't know about, struggles that he didn't, publicly speak directly about. But he fought them in a very positive way. So I had a great deal of respect for Arthur. He was my house guest many times, and I was impressed in that, yes, he not only opposed apartheid in South Africa, he would oppose voting discrimination in Georgia as well if he was alive today.
Okay, next we're going to call 3330. Call 3330. The mic is yours.
Thank you. Brother Green, I appreciate you sharing history and your context. And I just have a question in regards to your home state of Georgia. I want to know, what were your thoughts when the Atlanta Dream basketball team from WNBA took a major political stance and they openly protested against their then owner, who ended up selling the team much later?
Okay, I didn't quite hear that question again. Can you state it again?
Okay, can you all hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, Carl.
I can hear you now. And by the way, Georgia is not my home state. That's my dad's home state. My home state
okay.
was Michigan,
excuse
Detroit.
Me.
Okay.
Okay, excuse
Just
me.
A question.
Go ahead,
sir.
In regards to the state of Georgia, the Atlanta Dream basketball team recently took a political stance because Kelly Loeffler, who was running for Senate against Reverend Raphael Warnock, was the then owner of the team, and the women's team took a stance by openly campaigning and protesting against her. And I just wanted to know, what were your thoughts on in terms of when athletes decide to take these stances, especially given that there's a popular phrase in right-wing circles that they should just shut up and dribble?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, because when LeBron James spoke out against discrimination, one of the owners stated that LeBron should play basketball and forget about politics. I don't support that. I think athletes like Arthur Ashe and LeBron James, I respect and admire them when they use their influence and power to get young people to become registered voters and do the right thing from a social justice standpoint. So they have my support 100%. Jackie Robinson didn't have the power behind him that LeBron James has today. And so people, they speak out about LeBron James and And LeBron James speaks out for social justice, and I respect that.
Okay, Professor Green, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a quick station break, and when we come
okay,
back.
Okay, wow. Can you call me back? I've got Andrew Young calling me right now, and I need to talk
okay,
to him. Can you call me?
I tell you what we're going to do,
call
Professor,
me back?
Real quick. Give us a phone number where people can reach you who want to get your book or email.
I'm going to give it to you, right?
Right. Give it to me now.
Our phone number is 517-896-0395.
And on that night, Professor Green, we'd like to thank you for your contribution to today's show at the Crossroads of Field and Freedom. And we will stay in touch with you. And thank you again for your contribution.
And I will tell Andrew Jackson Young that I got off this important call to talk to him.
Thank you very much. All right, listen, audience, you listen to MPH Radio, as you just heard. We had Professor Robert L. Green, and for those who may be wondering why we have not really emphasized his different credentials, is that based upon this brother's demeanor, he doesn't stress and push his so-called credentials. So he likes to be viewed as just another brother at Kwame would say on the corner, trying to make his contribution to his people. So it's not out of any disrespect, but I think if you look at his works, many times he don't emphasize his so-called attributes. So at this point in time, what we're going to do right now on Missing Pages of History, we're going to pause for a call, take a station break, and when we come back, we will continue to discuss the importance of revising and re-looking at history as it relates to our brother Booker T. Washington. We will have a discussion on that. We'll be back. This is MPH Radio. If you would like a copy of this program, if you have any views or comments, we encourage you to email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. We also encourage you that if you like to become a friend and supporter of MPH Radio, write us and we can tell you how you can become a friend and supporter of this radio station. We need your participation. We need your help. And let's come build this thing together. So we'll be right back. This is Missing Pages of History Radio, MPH Radio.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you...
That's right. Welcome back to MPH Radio. If you had a choice of color, which one would you choose? Which one would you choose? That's still the question today. And we know that color does matter. So like a underserved oppressed community, we must speak from our perspectives and our realities. So we will continue this by having this dialogue as we look at history and as we discuss how do we move forward as a people, as a community. We welcome you back to MPH Radio, and we have a little dialogue, a little brief dialogue, we'll talk about history, revising history and relooking at history. Because we know scientifically speaking, the more things change, the more they remain the same. But is that true? No, it's not true. Because if it changes, it should not remain the same. But we do know that when we find new information, it does have an impact on our understanding of what we thought we knew. And in that concept, we're just going to talk about a new book is out by Sister Doreen Wright. She's a professor at the City College of New York. She wrote a really interesting book that may give us a different perspective, a different narrative of who was Booker T. Washington. The title of the book is Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist. Now, from her perspective, her writing, she talked about Booker T. Washington as a Pan-Africanist. That was something you very rarely hear about Booker T. Washington, because the narrative that is often taught to our children today is that he was one who seemed to have compromised, he was a sellout, you know, he was an Uncle Tom. But many times we got to understand that when our people are trying to advance our struggles, there are different methods, strategies, and tactics that they must use. Some may be public and some may not be public. And in this book, Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist, she highlights some of the works and contributions that Booker T. Washington made towards the African liberation struggle and movement. Was it dealing with the Free Congo State, the battle in the Congo, where King Leopold killed over 15 to 16 million of African people in the Congo? He talked about, or she talked about, the Liberia crisis, where, you know, other European countries wanted to colonize Liberia, and where he used his influence and weight to fight against that. And even more importantly, I think he just talked about, was concerned about the well-being of Africa, and he saw himself as an extension of being an African. So this is a real interesting book I think people should take. He, too, take a look at it and his role, his work in the field of working with his brothers and sisters and for his brothers and sisters in Africa and around the world. And one other interesting point I would like to raise into the context of Booker T. Washington and the work that he has contributed to our people for progress is that when you look at Tuskegee Institute that he created, that institute not only did it train and teach African people who were born in America, but also it trained and taught African people from other parts of the world, such as many brothers and sisters from Cuba went to Tuskegee Institute to learn how to be an architect, to learn how to make bricks, and they went back to their home in Cuba and built one of the first independent communities in Cuba. So we have to relook at this question again. Who was Brother Booker T. Washington? And we must be very careful about narratives that other people has written about our people and do our own research. And at this point in time, I'd like to bring in our Brother Alex, your response to this issue of taking another look at Booker T. Washington and his value and contribution to our people's struggle. Brother Alex, your thoughts.
Yes, Mr. Lee, when we think of our ancestors, Booker T. was coming out of the ending of the slave generation. And when you come out of a system that has always disenfranchised you, looked down upon you, cursed you, insulted you, then sometimes we become passive. Sometimes we bow our heads humbly to what is going on in our surroundings just to survive. Because we got to look at a time when a man was hung. If he said certain words to the white race. So he had to walk a very fine line of appeasement. That line won't be walked today, not by the generations that I've known. There's no more bowing that head. But to move forward, and look at the other contributions that can be made as far as invention, as far as like the young lady that helped with the vaccination. There are so many things that we can contribute and we can learn from Booker T. Because he was so many things. He's a very complex man in everything that he did. From the speeches he gave to the writings that he left behind. Booker T. Washington was a dedicated man to his own race in his own heart. Because he knew for the race to go forward at that particular time, certain accreditation had to be made. He could not force the envelope as is being done today. We didn't have the leaders in Congress. We didn't have a black president. There was nothing he had to stand on. So being an author, a great orator, he worked with many presidents advising them on Negro issues. And one of those issues was, yes, about Africa. Commerce, trade, education, a lot of different things. He sought scholarships for Tuskegee from Africans and from other countries all over the world. He wanted to build and bridge America into a true melting pot. But there were so many against him, even his own color, that said the time was not right for us to go to school together. The time was not right for us to work together. The time was not right for us to worship together. And so when you have opposition against you by your own, then sometimes you melt to that opposition, depending on how a humble person that you are. So we got to look back at the man himself and realize that in Booker T, there was no Malcolm X. There was no Stokely Carmichael. But his accomplishments still were just as great as any other black American. And his work for him to make America understand that the bridge between Africa and the African American should never be broken, that we should accept them as brothers always and accept their problems. That's why as Dr. Green, when he went to Africa, Arthur Ashe went to Africa, there's many athletes there, there's many politicians, many people have gone to Africa because there's much to learn from Africa. So Booker T dedicated his life in trying to find different resources and different talking points that he could combine the two continents together in friendship and trade. And these are the things that we don't know. These are the things that happen behind the scenes. These are the things that you don't learn about in history books, in library books. These are the things that men leave behind in memoirs. Letters to friends, personal notes here and there. But this is still our missing history. And I thank you, Slee.
And we'll get some thoughts on that with our sister, Susie, of MPH Radio. Susie, your thoughts on Booker T and this new narrative?
One thing about Booker T, I guess it's like Mr. Joyner hit a lot of the points on here. And everything, the thing of it is thank goodness we had a sister that decided to put this book out and make people aware of who Booker T. Washington was, because when I found out that Mr. Lee had the book, I had to look at it, because I was like, this is a contradiction of everything that I thought I learned in history. To come to find out that I only learned a very small portion of who Booker T. Washington was.
Thank you, Susie. And thank you, Susie. On that note, to our listening audience, our friends, supporter, we'd like to thank our special guest, Professor Brother Robert L. Green, who is the author of At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom, The Fight for Social and Educational Justice. If you'd like to get in contact with them, invite them to your community, your schools, or purchase a book, we ask you just write us. Write us at mphradio@yahoo.com. We will put you in contact with them. We will share the information. You either can go online to purchase a book, but we will supply the information if you contact us at mphradio@yahoo.com. For all our friends and supporters and listeners, if you'd like to become a supporter of this radio station and become a member of our fan club, friends and supporters of MPH Radio, please email us and let us know. You can send all of your gifts and contributions to Missing Pages of History, P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. We thank you and all the upcoming activities that has been planned by Missing Pages of History. We are still on hold because of the pandemic. And when we feel like it is safe to sign back, we will let you know. But until then, we'll see you on a biweekly basis every Saturday at 1 p.m. So until next time, come and join us. Help us to fill in our Missing Pages the history and support this radio station. Again, today's program theme was At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. We are here for all of us. We'll see you in 2 weeks. This has been MPH Radio.
wanna save the nation. With no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now